It is my pleasure to introduce to you Stephen Mosher, President of the Population Institute. His topic is Population Control, the Real Cost and Illusionary Benefits.
All right, I think I'm mic'd up. Can everyone hear me? I'm glad I missed that introduction. Long introductions are an exercise in humiliation. The shorter, the better. That was very short. I didn't hear a thing. Except Star Parker saying it was amazing. Star is amazing, isn't she? Yeah. Thank you for being here. I think we've met once or twice on the lecture trail, but...
Louder?
Okay. Can we... how's this? No difference. All right. Let me move it up a little bit. I don't want to blast everyone out of the room. How's this? Is this all right in the back? Molly? No? Oh. Okay. All right, I've moved it right up under my chin. So how's that? Is that much better? In the back? Okay, I'm hearing applause. Must mean something. Okay. So we're going to talk today about whether or not this room is overpopulated. All right? Now, there are a lot of people who complain about there being too many people in the world, and whenever they get in a situation where they're trapped in a traffic jam or they're on a crowded plane on a flight to, say, Australia, a 14-hour flight across the South Pacific, they complain about there being so many people. Without realizing, of course, that if there weren't all those people on the plane, they couldn't afford to fly it. And if there weren't all those people on the freeway, there wouldn't be a freeway in the first place. So we're gonna go through this this subject point by point. I've got a series we put together at the Population Research Institute, a series of short YouTube videos which run about 2 minutes each. And I'm going to show them one after the other, and then I'm going to comment on them. And I think you'll find them very interesting. Before I do so, let me tell you, however, how I became interested in this subject. In 1979, I was in the anthropology department at Stanford University. China, after being hidden behind the bamboo curtain for 30 years, opened up to the West. And the United States signed a scholarly exchange agreement with the People's Republic of China to allow Chinese scholars to come here and American scholars to go to China. It was a very fair agreement. 10,000 Chinese scholars came to the United States, and the Chinese government allowed 50 of us to go to China. That sort of set the tone for U.S.-China relations ever since. Well, of the 50, there was one proposal that was turned down, mine. The reason it was turned down was that I was a social scientist, and I can read, write, and speak Chinese. And I wanted to find out what life was like after 30 years of communism. Well, they didn't want me to find out what life was like after 30 years of communism, for good reason, it turned out, I was to find out. They were happy to have American nuclear physicists come into the country and teach them nuclear physics, and chemical engineers come into the country and teach them chemical engineering. But they were not happy about having an inquisitive social scientist running around the countryside talking to the Chinese people in their own language. But Jimmy Carter brought up the matter with China's senior leader, Deng Xiaoping, and said, why won't you allow our American researcher from Stanford to come into the country? And Deng Xiaoping, interested in good U.S.-China relations, said that won't be a problem. Well, when China's dictator says something won't be a problem, it generally isn't. So I was allowed to go into South China, into a commune about 80 miles up the Pearl River from Hong Kong. And I was there when the one-child policy began. Now, because Deng Xiaoping had personally given me permission to be there and do my research, all doors were open to me, including the door to the local abortion clinic, which began to fill up rapidly after the onset of the one-child policy, because the local government, the local Communist Party officials were under orders to identify all women who were pregnant with second, third, and higher order children. And they did that with typical totalitarian efficiency. They told all these women who were pregnant with illegal children, as they were now declared to be, that they must go in for abortions. And when they refused, some of them went in as ordered. When those who were 5 months, 7 months, 9 months pregnant refused to go in, they were then summarily arrested. Now, I have copies of the arrest warrants that were issued. And on the arrest warrant, in the block where you write the crime that the person being arrested is being charged with, was written the words, Huayun, which means pregnant. These women were arrested for the crime of being pregnant without the permission of the state. They were taken away from their homes and families to the local seat of government. They were locked up in a tiny room and subjected to morning to night propaganda sessions. Now, the Chinese Communist Party invented brainwashing in the 1930s, and it was using brainwashing techniques in 1980 when this policy began. And these women, these young women, were browbeaten. They were threatened. They were told they had no choice but to get an abortion. They were told that if they refused an abortion until the end of their pregnancy, that as soon as they went into labor, they would be taken anyway to the abortion clinic, and they would there be aborted, and they would go home alone. So they were threatened with forced abortion. They were threatened with infanticide, and those threats were actually carried out. Remember, all doors were open to me. I went with these women as they went to the local abortion center. I saw them given lethal injections into the abdomen of a poison intended to cause the death of their unborn children. I saw them as they were opened up like tin cans in cesarean section abortions done at 8 and 9 months. And their now dead babies were removed from their bodies. I saw them wounded in both body and spirit. And of course, their children killed. Now, two things happened to me while I was in that operating room watching these babies being killed and watching their mothers being grievously wounded. The first thing that happened to me was that I became pro-life. Now, I hadn't been pro-life up to that point. I had been pro-choice, which, of course, is a misnomer. They're not, the other side is not pro-choice. The other side is pro-abortion. And I say that from personal experience because when I came back from China and tried to get people like the National Organization of Women who claimed to be pro-choice to enter into the lists on this subject, to fight with me against forced abortions on women carrying wanted children who would, if they had a choice, would choose life. The head of the National Abortion Organization of Women said to me, well, I'm personally opposed to forced abortion. But after all, China does have a population problem. So they're not pro-choice, they're pro-abortion and pro-population control. The other thing that happened to me in that room was I realized that I was confronting evil in its most undiluted, unadulterated sense. The killing of a healthy baby at birth is the worst evil I can imagine. An abortion is the worst evil I can imagine. The killing of an innocent human being before it has a chance to draw its first breath. And I recoiled from that evil, but that evil had something to teach me. It taught me that there was evil about in the world. Now, you remember, I came from a background in academia where I thought everything was shades of gray. Everything was relative. Morals were relative, right? Moral relativism. Ethics were situational. Well, it might be all right under some circumstances to... No, there was nothing that could justify the killing of babies at or near birth. And so in recoiling from that evil, I began to seek the good. And if you seek the good, you will be led to the source of all goodness, who is God. So I call my conversion story, which I am not going to tell you today, Finding God in China, because I did find God in China in an odd sort of way. And that set me on the road to conversion. So back to the population question. I also began to think about China and to think about whether or not China was indeed overpopulated. And the longer I was in China, the more I realized that China's problem was not too many people. China's problem was too much government, too corrupt a government. China's problem was the lack of freedom of speech, the lack of freedom of assembly, the lack of freedom of conscience, the lack of freedom of association, the lack of private property, lack of the rule of law. China's governed today as it was then by a group called the Chinese Communist Party, which is actually a kind of mafia which uses its monopoly on force to stay in power and has used its monopoly on force to take control of the reproductive systems of everybody in China. The Chinese Communist Party tells you when you can have children and when you can't. The Chinese Communist Party tells you how many children you can have. The party tells you when you can get married. And the Chinese Communist Party says that you should only have perfect children. Yosheng in Chinese, superior births. And if you give birth to an inferior child, government doctors will often put it to death without asking you. And because of the emphasis on superior births, Yosheng, because of the one-child policy, many Chinese parents will abandon a baby who is somehow less than perfect. A cleft palate, a clubbed foot is enough to get a baby abandoned. Even a facial blemish in some cases has been enough to have parents discard newborn children like rubbish. Because they can only have one child, or in the countryside sometimes now two, and they want that only child, the state has told them, to be perfect. So it's a eugenics policy. But it is driven in China. The Chinese one-child policy is basically a Western import. We import a lot of things from China, but they imported the notion of overpopulation from us. They originally didn't believe it in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. But when they opened up to the West in the late 1970s and they began to import our science and technology, they also imported the myth of overpopulation. And so they embarked upon their own population control program, mimicking what we do in the West in places like Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Because we, through our tax dollars, through our foreign aid agency, push population control on peoples everywhere. But let's go back to the making of the myth. Let's show the first YouTube video, which is called Overpopulation, The Making of a Myth.
The myth of overpopulation originated in England in 1798. When a vicar named Thomas Malthus, who fancied himself something of a mathematician, saw that food production increased incrementally, but people reproduced exponentially. He sat down and did some simple math, and summarily decided that the world would be out of food by 1890. He blamed reduced mortality rates, and recommended killing off the have-nots of society, lest the haves starve to death. This cry was taken up by Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University in 1968, who claimed that reckless human reproduction had overwhelmed the earth. Massive famines would result, which would destroy, best case scenario, one-fifth of humanity by the end of the 70s, and the planet would follow. This fear produced large donations for the newly created UNFPA, which thrives on an imagined crisis that has been both imminent and rescheduled again and again over the past two centuries. The truth of the matter is that every family on this planet could have a house with a yard and all live together on a landmass the size of Texas, which is really just a small corner of the planet. The population of Earth will peak in 30 years and then start to go back down. We're not overpopulated. Do the math.
The myth of overpopulation is not just a harmless fairy tale. It is a myth that kills, and it has killed from the beginning. It killed literally tens of millions of people in India in the 19th century. And you ask, how did that happen? Well, Thomas Malthus was an economic advisor to something called the British East India Company, which had the royal charter to govern India in the name of the British Empire. And he told the members of the British East India Company that it was pointless to respond in Christian love and charity to the frequent famines that happened in India, in this province or that province. He said it was pointless to do that because the Indians were simply having too many children, and that population growth would always outstrip food supply. And if you saved starving people today by feeding them, they would simply go on to have large families, and in another few years or a decade, you would have another famine, which would kill even more people because there would be more people to die. So he convinced the British East India Company not to help out, not to follow their natural instincts to help in the case of famines in India, but just to let people die, and die they did. The same logic, or illogic, was applied during the Irish potato famine. Some of you are probably of Irish descent and remember that famine that gripped the Emerald Isle in the 1850s and left over 1 million dead and sent 1 million or 2 heading for the ships to go overseas where there might be, they might find food. Responding to the theory of overpopulation, the Malthusian theory, the British government decided not to send food aid to Ireland to help stave off famine, instead to let the Irish die, because after all, there were too many Irish and there was too little food and the Irish were having too many children, and so it was basically their own fault. They were starving. And if we kept them from starving this year, they would only be starving. There would only be a more serious famine a few years in the future, and so people were left to die. So this is the idea behind the myth of overpopulation, that there are too many people in the planet, there are too many people for the planet to support, and that that we might as well let the four horsemen of the apocalypse work their will, because people are doomed to die in large numbers anyway. My former colleague at Stanford University, Paul Ehrlich, I was in the anthropology department. He was in the biology department, by the way. I know he writes books about human beings, but he's actually an expert on monarch butterflies, okay? He knows more about monarch butterflies than anybody else in the world. And I respect his expertise in that area. If you want to know anything about monarch butterflies, Paul Ehrlich is the guy to go to. But he doesn't know very much about human beings. And he rather blindly applied his knowledge of monarch butterflies to human beings, and monarch butterfly populations peak and crash over the years. And he predicted in 1968 in his book, The Population Bomb, that hundreds of millions of people would starve to death in the 1970s. Hundreds of millions of people. The opening sentence of his book goes something like this: the battle to feed humanity is over. Hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in the 1970s. Well, those of you who lived through the 1970s, as I did, will remember that hundreds of millions of people did not starve to death. Instead, we had the Green Revolution, when Norman Borlaug invented new strains of grain, higher-yielding varieties that took India from being an importer of grain to being an exporter of grain. So what did Paul Ehrlich do? Did he admit that he'd been wrong? Did he say, I'm sorry for my failed predictions? No, he wrote another book 10 years later called The Population Explosion. He went from the population bomb to the population explosion. And in The Population Explosion, he said, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in the 1990s. So you see, he just pushed back his predictions by 10 years or so. Well, those of you who lived through the 1990s will know. Anyway, so that's Paul Ehrlich. But the myth lives on, and the myth is deadly. Let's go on to the next one.
From the time of the cavemen all the way until today, humanity continues to exist because each generation of people has produced another generation to replace itself. Scientists have figured out how many people need to be born each generation to replace the generation before. That number is one person per person. All things being equal, this creates perfect demographic balance. Since women are the only ones who can have children, replacing every person on Earth means each woman needs to have 2 children, one to replace her, and the other to replace the man, who cannot have children. The total fertility rate is the average number of children each woman in a society is having. This number shows us if a society is growing or shrinking. In developed countries, the replacement rate, birth rate, is 2.1 children per woman. This will keep the population stable, but even that is assuming that every woman has children and that there are no wars, famines, or disease. In the real world, disasters happen all the time, and sadly, not all children reach adulthood, especially in poor countries. This pushes their replacement rate up to 3.3 children per woman. Since not every woman wants to have children, in order to keep the population stable, some women need to have more than 2.1 children to balance the birth rate with the women who are only having 1 or no children at all. Maintaining this balance is of the utmost importance. If society does not at least replace itself every generation, human numbers begin to fall exponentially. Economic and social problems appear as elderly people retiring begin to outnumber young people entering the workplace. But this is already happening all over the developed world. Many of the world's nations are only barely replacing themselves, while a growing majority have birth rates below replacement, some as low as 1.8 or even 1.2 babies per woman. Many societies are facing a very real danger: extinction.
birth rates falling all over the world and falling farther and faster than anyone could have imagined 50 years ago. In Europe, of course, birth rates have been so low for so long that the European populations, the populations of countries in Europe, are shrinking from year to year. The Germans are filling more coffins than cradles. So are the Italians, the Spaniards as well. In Germany, they're closing down maternity wards, and they're opening up geriatric clinics in the hospitals. The developed countries of Asia are in the same straits. Japan, for example, South Korea, Taiwan, China because of the one-child policy. Places like Thailand, you wouldn't think of as having low birth rates, now have birth rates below replacement. That means their populations are shrinking or will shrink over time. The Japanese Ministry of Industry calculates that by the year 3000, at the current Japanese total fertility rate of about 1.3 children, there will only be 500 Japanese left. Currently, the population is 126 million. Now, I don't know how many Japanese there will be alive in the year 3000. I don't expect to be here. But the fact is, it is a statistical certainty that if the Japanese population of 126 million continues to have only 1.3 children on average per woman over her reproductive lifetime, that the population will be cut in half and cut in half and cut in half again until, yes, by the year 3000, there will only be 500 left. The Japanese population is already aging rapidly and shrinking. They're losing people from year to year in Japan as well. And that's led to some rather crazy things happening there. They're developing humanoid robots in Japan that are about the size of toddlers. And they represent the grandchildren that elderly Japanese don't have. And they're programmed to ask questions like, in Japanese, like, Grandpa, why is the sky blue? And Grandma, why do birds fly? And what they are is little humanoid robots to take the place of the missing grandchildren. It is also the case in Japan that elderly Japanese can rent a family with young children for the weekend. So if you don't have any children or grandchildren and you miss that aspect of human life, you can rent from Friday night to Sunday evening young couple, a father and mother with one or two young children, so that you can pretend for 72 hours or less that you actually do have children and grandchildren when in fact you don't have any. So that's the situation in the developed countries, but worldwide the total fertility rate is now down to about 2.6 children. Latin America, birth rates are lower than most people in the United States understand. You know, Mexico, the average Mexican senora in 1960 had six children. Today she has less than two. The Mexican birth rate is below replacement. This current generation of young Mexicans we have is the last large generation we will see. The villages and towns in Mexico are emptied out. The young people have come here, they've gone to the cities. There aren't nearly as many in the next generation. And the reason is population control. Back in 1972, Mexico set up a national population council. The rule in Mexico is that every woman who goes into a government hospital to give birth in Mexico is given either a tubal ligation or an IUD. It's supposedly voluntary, but imagine being in labor, coming into a government-run hospital, and having a doctor shove a sheaf of papers in your face written in tiny print in legalese and saying, you know, Senora, sign this. Well, you're in labor. You don't want to sign anything. You want him to get out of your face. So you sign it or you initial it. And what it is permission to do a tubal ligation or insert an IUD. I held a press conference exposing this a few years ago in Washington, D.C. We had one woman we brought up from Mexico who had four IUDs removed. Four IUDs removed, which had been inserted without her foreknowledge or consent after the birth of her children. But she knew because years went by and she didn't get pregnant that she had an IUD, so she had the first one removed, and after that she was on to them, and she had the second, third, and fourth one removed as well. But that's why the birth rate in Mexico now, total fertility rate, is down at about 1.9, 1.8 or so. So the Mexican population over time will stop growing and start shrinking. The same is true of most South American countries. Central American birth rates are still a little higher than that, but falling rapidly. So you have birth rates falling in Asia. You have birth rates falling in Latin America. Of course, North America is below replacement. The recession has only made the birth dearth in the United States worse. The only continent or part of a continent with still robust fertility is sub-Saharan Africa. Now, the reason birth rates are high in sub-Saharan Africa is because death rates are high. Okay? If you know that half your children are going to die before they reach adulthood, if you know that the infant child mortality rate in your country is 30, 40, 45%, then you're going to have four or five children because you want at least two to survive to adulthood. So I told Bill Gates 10 years ago, I said, if you're worried about high birth rates in Africa, help improve the primary health care system there. Do something about malaria, typhus, typhoid, yellow fever, waterborne diseases of all kinds. Do something about amoebic dysentery. Do something about the diseases that sweep away HIV AIDS, that sweep away millions of people in Africa each year. Because if you do that, if you lower the mortality rate, then the birth rate will come down naturally without coercion. I thought he was listening at the time, but Melinda Gates hasn't gotten the message because she's out there going to spend Bill's billions on population control programs, having been convinced that the way to have Africans have smaller families is to abort, sterilize, and contracept as many as possible. It's an immoral approach, and it's an approach that doesn't make any demographic sense. So our long-term problem is not going to be too many people. In many countries today, you can see their immediate problem is too few people, and that problem will spread to the rest of the world soon enough. Let's go on to the next one. Food.
According to believers in overpopulation, there are so many of us on the planet that food production cannot possibly keep up. However, according to both the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization and the World Food Program, there is currently enough food on the planet for everyone to be well fed. Not only that, but we're growing this food on less land than we did in the past. This is why, in the United States, for example, the government can afford to pay farmers not to grow food, but instead return their farmland to the wild. Modern technology also allows us to grow food on land where it would have been impossible to do so, even a few years ago. Agricultural experts even believe that Africa, if cultivated using modern farming methods, could eventually feed the whole world, all by itself. Then why are people in many parts of the world starving? The World Food Program lists key causes of hunger, and overpopulation is not on that list. War, one of the leading causes of world hunger, destroys crops and disrupts relief efforts. Widespread poverty prevents many from buying the food that they need. And a lack of infrastructure means that there isn't a reliable way to transport food to areas that need it. This is why reducing the number of hungry people will not make the remaining people less hungry. Those who have access to the food will continue to have access to it, and those who don't will still be hungry. Reducing population will not magically cause food to be spread around equally. And blaming overpopulation for everything does nothing but distract us from the real problems that we actually have. Think about it.
Let me tell you about the worst famine in human history. A famine not caused by overpopulation, but caused by government mismanagement of the economy. It happened in China from 1960 to 1962. As a prelude to the famine, during the 1950s, Chairman Mao herded all of the Chinese villagers into great people's communes. 60, 80,000 people were to farm the fields in common, fields that were now owned by the state. Food production went way down. Wasted time in government meetings, propaganda meetings went way up. By 1960, there was a nationwide food shortage. Over the course of the next 2 years, 42.5 million people died, mostly in China's villages. Mao let them starve. He refused to admit to the world there was a famine, and he actually sent the People's Liberation Army out into the villages to gather the last stores of grain from starving villagers in order to feed the army and to feed people in the cities, including his Communist Party apparatchiks. So it was a deliberate choice on his part to hide the famine and to let villagers starve. And tens of millions did. Not a famine caused by overpopulation, but a famine caused by government mismanagement of the economy. Let's go on to the 7 billion, and I will end with that one. We have one called 7 billion people.
At some point in the year 2011, the Earth will hold 7 billion people on its surface, more people than any point in recorded history. While some welcome this latest member of humanity with excitement, others with fear. When people hear that we've been adding 1 billion people every 15 years, they imagine humanity's growth to look something like this. But 1 billion people isn't as high a percentage of humanity as it used to be. For instance, imagine this roller coaster car represents 1 billion people. If we add another car, or 1 billion more people, our train has doubled in length. But if we want to double the train again, we can't just add one more train car. We'd have to add two. Every time we make the train longer, one train car represents a smaller and smaller percentage of the train. If it takes 15 years to add each new train car, then mathematically speaking, the growth rate is slowing. In order for the growth rate to stay constant, the train would have to keep doubling every 15 years, instead of just adding one car. Human population growth is the same way. In 1804, the world's population hit 1 billion. By 1927, that number had doubled. But by 1960, that number had only grown by half. By 1975, it was only growing by a third, and then a fourth, and then a fifth. To see how population growth is slowing down, we look at a number called the global total fertility rate, which is the average number of children each woman is having. And over the last 40 years, that rate has been rapidly falling. According to the UN's current data, the world's population is due to peak in 25 years. After it peaks, it will start to go down. By the end of the century, we'll be losing 1 billion people every 20 years. This year, the world's population will hit 7 billion. In 75 years, we'll be back here again. Think about it.
So when we hit 7 billion people in the world a couple of months ago, we at the Population Research Institute sent out a press release saying, "Welcome, baby 7 billion. That was not the message that you were hearing from Planned Parenthood or the population control enthusiasts. But we welcome baby 7 billion because as our numbers have grown, our prosperity has grown even faster. We're better off at 7 billion people than we were at 6 or 5 or 4 billion in terms of per capita income. After World War II, there were 3 billion of us. Average lifespans were about 38 years. Now, at 7 billion, average lifespans are almost 70 years, and every month that goes by, we add a week to the average lifespan. We're eating better than ever before on average. Average calorie consumption is up. We have better health care. We have better access to educational opportunities, cultural opportunities, and travel. So that as our numbers have grown, as you have more creative human intelligences at work, those intelligences have made life better for everyone. So what is there not to like about this picture? I went on Fox to say this, Star, and when I got done saying it, my interviewer said to the audience, "You will not hear this on any other station." And he was right. CNN did not invite me on. But it's true. We are better off at 7 billion than we were at 5 billion, at 4 billion, at 3 billion, by any measure of human well-being, including the best measure of human well-being, which is lifespans. Obviously, if we were overpopulated, lifespans would be shrinking, but they're lengthening. Now, the other side doesn't like this. I debated Sir David Attenborough some time ago. And he said on the air that the human race has become a plague on the earth. Well, I believe there is room enough on God's green earth for all of us. I believe that to claim that we are running out of room is nonsense, because you could fit the entire population of the world in the state of Texas and give everybody a single family dwelling with a front and backyard. It's also nonsense because I think that to claim the world is overpopulated is to doubt God's providence. And I believe in God's providence. I believe that God, at the beginning of time, created a world that would be sufficient for us as our numbers and our needs grew. and that he prepositioned resources that we would unlock over time as our technology improved, as we put our minds to work, that we would use to support ourselves as our numbers grew. And so there's plenty of room on God's green earth for all of us. And that population control programs, that overpopulation is a myth, and population control programs should be stopped tomorrow. We should be spending our money helping people to improve their lives, helping to improve health care, primary health care in places like Africa, not trying to prevent children from being conceived and born. Thank you. May I have some time for questions?
Thank you very, very much. Amazing presentation again. And I certainly learned a lot in this one presentation. In fact, I was thinking, sitting, that I'm not only going to review this information in our Cleveland Right to Life Symposium / University, but I'm going to be posting it on my website and on my resources, and I'm hoping that all of you will consider doing the same. We have a little bit of time for some Q&A, and Molly reminded me that she is not the one to force you into a fast. That's up to the Lord and you, so we are going to have lunch right after this session. Just a few more stomach growls. But let's look at, even though populations are shrinking and at a slow rate, and we are, but they're asking basically that we're using up the earth's resources. And if we continue using at this particular rate, aren't we going to run out of these resources?
I have a microphone. I'm not going to steal yours.
Okay.
All right. The question is resources. Now this is a favorite argument of the population control types, that we're using up resources and that eventually we will run out. Now, this myth goes back to a Club of Rome report published in the early 1970s. And the Club of Rome report got major media coverage in Time, Newsweek, the New York Times, and so forth. And they predicted we would run out of zinc in 1988, and chromium in 1990, and petroleum in 1995, and so on and so forth. There was a deadline, literally a deadline, for every mineral resource that we used. Well, the whole study was a hoax. It was a hoax because the two Massachusetts Institute of Technology systems engineers, the Matthews, who did the study, were told that they had to assume no new technological advances, number one. They had to assume, number two, that there were no new discoveries of resources. Well, if you assume going in that you're not going to be prospecting for more petroleum or seeking out more zinc or chromium, you're not going to find any. And eventually you're going to run out of your known reserves. But these deadlines, these artificial dates, were an artifact of the assumptions going in. It was kind of a garbage in, garbage out scenario. So we continue to explore. Technology continues to improve. And you see, as our numbers grow, that process accelerates. And it's not hard to understand how population growth drives economic advance. The population grows, you have temporary shortages in goods and services. In a free economy, those shortages are a signal to entrepreneurs, to businessmen, to engineers to come forward and engineer and devise solutions to the shortages in goods and services. And so new technologies are developed, new methods of manufacturing are developed, new resources are found. You replace one material that's in short supply or becoming expensive with another one. And at the end of this process, you have more goods and services available at a lower price precisely because of population growth. So I do not believe that we're going to run out of any resources. But as certain elements become rare, we will find substitutes. Instead of, you know, if we run out of platinum, we will use palladium. If we run out of this material, we will use that. And I believe there are resources out there that are available to us that we do not now know about. Who would have imagined 50 years ago that silica, which is on the beaches, you know, the sand that's on every beach in the world, would be the means that we use to communicate to each other using computers, cell phones, iPads, and so forth. So there are other discoveries waiting to be made.
And let's remind ourselves that some of those discoveries are still in the womb or in the future wombs, as we think about right. people like Steve right. Jobs, who was Steve Jobs was born of a single college student. She was unmarried and she was a college student. It was a very, very difficult time, and he grew up then as a result in an adopted family. Adoption is a beautiful, beautiful option. All right, for those of you that are saying, but my question wasn't asked, you will hear your question asked later on Molly's radio program, because we only have time for two questions. And the next question is, why isn't government blamed for food not being distributed that sits and rots on the port if our concern is that we don't have enough food? And he says that his son actually saw this occurring. Or is this something you're familiar with?
Well, I assume he's referring to Public Law 480 food aid, which is shipped from the United States to countries around the world. Now, the government is not known for its efficiency, all right? The government tries to do many things. A few of them it does well. Most of them it does poorly. Food aid does not get, in, for the most part, to the people for whom it is intended. I don't want to get off into foreign aid, but 30 cents out of every foreign aid dollar is wasted on the bureaucracy in Washington, doesn't even get sent overseas. Some of the food aid, I will tell you this, some of the food aid arrives in places like Ethiopia, and the local distributors of the food aid, the government is told that your most pressing problem is not your starving millions, but the fact that you don't have enough IUDs, Depo-Provera, birth control pills, and so forth. And so they are advised to sell the food aid, the food on the open market, and use the proceeds to fund population control programs, which is an absolute disgrace. But that's happened in Peru, it's happened in Africa, it's happened in other places. So the food that's supposed to feed the starving millions instead is used to buy IUDs to insert in women's wombs so they won't have children. Now, I write books about these things, and you can probably tell I have more to say, but I'm not going to have time to say it. My conversion story is in a book called Chosen, which I have on the table outside. If you want to find out more about the one-child policy, this is a mother's ordeal. It's not the story of my wife. And our nine children. It's the story of a woman in China who was a population control enforcer, forcing women to have abortions, and then she herself became pregnant with an illegal second child and tried to save its life. So she went on the run. And then finally, the issue we've been talking about today, population control, overpopulation, is in this book called Population Control, Real Costs, Illusory Benefits. So for the readers in the audience, these books are available. And I'll be happy to stand by and answer any questions you have afterwards.
Well, thank you for that, Stephen Mosher. In fact, he will also be standing by. Give him applause. Thank you. He will also be standing by to my right for photographs for anyone that wants that photograph. And I want to remind those of you that have been here in the past how important those photographs are as we talk about China, that when Reggie's little John was here and she talked to us about the fate of Guangchang, when he was in China trying to stop this one-child policy, that we all came up, we took photos with her and put on our little dark glasses. And who would have thought an amazing miracle of the Lord that within just a matter of months after our prayer that Chen Guangchen was escaped. He was not released. He escaped and came to our beautiful country. So the pictures are important of all of our speakers. So he'll be here on the right. Dr. Moser will be here. Remember to visit his book.
You have been listening to Stephen Mosher, president of the Population Institute and 2013 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker.